Okay, the concept of...
The concept of radical is having early currency, then discarded, and then rebirth, and all of this happening before carbonium mines and carbon mines really had very much currency.
Of course, Lapward has some sort of carbonines written in 1900 or thereabouts. I mean, if you look at the structures, they look awfully modern. Much about the
yes.
electronic structures.
I never got into that literature. I went back to about 1910, and I ran into some Lapward stuff
mm-hmm.
in 1910, particularly on the E2 elimination reaction,
mm-hmm.
The base catalyzed elimination reaction. And I was surprised at its sophistication. I remember that distinction. But I haven't looked at that since.
Yeah. I think these are the bromination of ketones and things of that sort way back in 1900 when he did some kinetics even. And then Bartlett picked up some of that stuff later on in the 1930s. But it had been done even earlier.
Well, he had some 1,2 diphenyl systems of some sort where he followed the stereochemistry of elimination.
Mm-hmm. That was the 1910 work you're talking about.
Yeah, it's very early.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Found that you've got nice clean transelimination, although I don't think he knew the relative configurations.
Yeah.
But it was all there. If you knew the configurations, it was all there.
Yeah. I think there was a fair amount of work being done in the early 1900s, but people didn't understand it completely, and there were only a few people here and there. It wasn't until people started to accept the Lewis structures that things could begin to take off.
Yeah.
This was, and the
yeah,
English
that was the key.
The English seemed to accept it a little bit earlier than the Americans did, for some reason.
They had a bigger operation than they could afford to, in some ways. Well, of course, they were not as geographically diluted.
Yes.
But
there wasn't much chemistry going on in the United States before World War I.
There wasn't
that's
much
right.
before World War I.
Right.
And, in fact, we didn't really get going until after World War II, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't become competitive until after World War II. By competitive, I don't think we were doing as well as the English and Germans.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Tom Jacobs suggested this morning there was just a hiatus during the war, and I'm not sure that physical organic chemistry didn't get a real boost during the war, because a lot of people came together and were beginning to think in those terms. It was certainly true at Harvard from about 41 to 45. There were a lot of people you mentioned, Gardner Swain and George Hammond and Henry Kluge were and
Harold Ford
Bill Sager. Sid Ross was there
and
people like that were all sitting there just talking about chemistry, and they were anxious to do it too, and they were also approaching these wartime problems as physical organic chemists as opposed to just turning it out to make it useful right.
Harvard was there were these people there and they were obviously worrying about problems during that period, but I suspect that their inability to work on these problems didn't help. They were thinking about it more than working.
I see.
They were doing applied research.
Well, I talked to Sid Ross this summer, and he said that they'd be sitting around and they'd worry about some problem, and they figured the only way to solve it was to go into a laboratory, and a whole bunch of papers came out that had nothing to do with the wartime work, because I think they were like you, they were eager to get work done, and they solved the problem by going in and just trying to do it in a laboratory. I think the war, in some sense, may have been an advantage for these people.
Well, there's one thing about stopping and starting. When you start afresh, you ask what is the important thing to do rather than doing what you did yesterday.
Yeah.
So I think it was important in that sense.
Yeah.
Also, it was a period, of course, where people left jobs and new people came into jobs.
Yeah.
It was an infusion of youth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, right after the war, there was a tremendous mixing of foreign and American chemists, mm-hmm. greater than they've ever been before.
Yeah.
And I think this was a tremendous stimulation. Stimulant.
Yeah.
People were coming over here from Europe, and people were going from here to Europe, mm-hmm. and then coming back. And this undoubtedly gave rise to the sense of excitement that people had in the late 40s and early 50s.
Who did you have in mind that was doing this kind of thing? I know Engel came in the late 40s. Were you talking about other people?
Well, Fieser followed the troops and went around, visited all the labs, and he came back, told us all about various people that he'd encountered, including Hans Meerwein, who at the time was probably 65 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the various Loupnant, I forget who all, but, mm-hmm. And he saw who's the fellow that was a pretty good Nazi that was
Reppe
in Heidelberg.
Is it
no Reppe? I know Reppe quite well.
Yeah.
I remember the stories about Reppe at that time. The fellow that was in the Institute in Heidelberg. Gosh, he died. He did the I think he did the alien multiple alien compounds. And oh,
we'll think of it later.
I'll think of his name later. And there were, when I was at Harvard, I remember a number of foreigners coming through giving seminars.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be a little hard put to say.
Yeah, no, I just, okay. So
there were.
It wasn't just the students who was,
this particularly to the second year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was right after the war.
Yeah. Okay, so there was that greater interaction that was taking place that hadn't taken place before.
And of course there was wartime corps. Actually, you know, the wartime cooperation, the penicillin project of the British, I think had quite an effect on American chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
The best were competing with the best in each country on the structure of it and,
mm-hmm.
and synthesis of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a tremendous effort, in some ways unparalleled,
mm-hmm.
historically. And of course, the effort on the steroids had been an international effort prior to that time. And of course, all the vitamin and coenzyme cofactors that came through in the 30s mm-hmm. that have been had what were international competition type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that there was an accumulative effect of what industry was doing in the United States. See, I think American chemical industry, Merck was quite a place. And the Squibb was quite a place in those days.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been the two best places for natural products and for elucidating structures and, mm-hmm. and synthesis, total synthesis,
mm-hmm.
in the States. And a lot of people, in effect, graduated from those two places. It was like a university in some ways. They went to other industries.
Yeah.
So. The educational operation was going on both, I think, in universities and in industry. American industry was building up. This is true in the polymer industry, too,
mm-hmm.
Of course. And the fact that the U.S. had an industry of building, whereas there wasn't any in Japan and Germany, and England had to sort of regroup.
Yeah.
France is still staggering under the losses, manpower in World War I,
mm-hmm.
and Russia was in a mess. So it's obvious where the action is going to have to be for the first while. And so there was a tendency for the whole world, in some ways, to concentrate its resources on the United States
mm-hmm.
and invest in it, in a sense.
Yeah.
Sending postdocs, and there's a flood of foreign postdocs that came through here in the early mm-hmm. 50s.
Yeah.
In fact, is we were fortunate enough to have a lot of the people now that occupied chairs came through and spent summers with us
mm-hmm.
out here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What about money at that particular time, where suddenly money was becoming available from the government as well?
Well, not very much until Sputnik. Some, mainly from the armed forces. The Navy first,
and then the AAC.
Then the Army. Uh-huh. And the AAC in certain fields.
Yeah. If you used an isotope in your work, you know.
Yeah, I never had any problems with money. Since the storeroom was open to everybody, and we didn't keep track of who paid for what until later on.
Mm-hmm.
And the students were all on TAs. There weren't any such thing as RAs, research assistantships.
Uh-huh.
And I got a little bit of money from Upjohn, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And
when did you start to?
I started consulting there in 1952. I've consulted about 10 days a year ever since. I spent over a year there, 28 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been good because it's kept me up in a lot of fields I wouldn't.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been in my field of expertise, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
I've also consulted Union Carbide since 1962. That's been good for me because I learned a lot about polymer work. And again, it's not my field of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's better to consult where you are not expert and where you're non-competitive.
Yeah, you probably have a more open mind, and you can be...
More than that, there isn't any conflict of interest either.
Yeah. Right.
Actually, I think those consultancies played quite an important role in the development of American science. I think that's been a very positive thing in
mm-hmm.
American education.
Yeah.
Because it left the professors a hell of a lot better educated. I'm not sure how much it did for industry, but I think it did a lot for...
Someone I talked to recently said that...
academia.
They were doing... the industrial outfits were doing less and less of this, and they tried to convince them that was a big mistake.
I think they're doing less of it now.
Yeah, but it's not smart for...
The pharmaceutical houses aren't. They're doing a lot of it still.
Mm-hmm.
The oil companies and whatnot are doing less.
Well, the oil companies just aren't even hiring organic chemists these days, from what I understand. I have a friend at SO who says there isn't an organic chemist around, even though I think Brown is... what would you say about the future of organic chemistry today? Where is it going? Where are the big problems going to be?
In the immediate, in the present, right now, organic chemistry. Always there's a center, and the center is synthesis. And then there are blends of the center with the periphery, high June.
Oh.
Good night, Joan. Then there's now, there's all sorts of things on the periphery, which are perhaps in many ways, at least temporarily, more important than the center. One is bioorganic or biotic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working in this field of what we call host-guest chemistry. Clearly the...
I'm not familiar with your host-guest work.
We started out about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been synthesizing compounds designed to do some of the kinds of things that biological systems do. We've been studying complexation,
mm-hmm.
both of transition states, that's catalysis, and of ground states,
mm-hmm.
which is equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
and trying to make a science out of complexation. And well, we've written maybe 50 papers on it so far, and it's my total effort now,
mm-hmm.
and it's quite broad, and we're trying to assemble, for example, the the same kinds of functional groups and the same arrangements as you find in chymotrypsin to catalyze transacylation.
Mm-hmm.
We've made chiral catalysts that will catalyze Michael additions and get up to 99 enantiomeric excess in some cases. And we've made compounds that will, by extraction, sort out the enantiomers of amino acids by extraction,
mm-hmm.
by design synthesis, looking at CPK molecular models
mm-hmm.
beforehand. And we have X-ray structures on maybe 30, 35 compounds, complexes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting some feeling for see, complexation plays a central role in biochemistry.
Right.
And in regulatory system and information storage and retrieval and genetic systems and of course enzymes and all. And so we're trying to do something synthetically with the same thing, starting with just synthesis, not using natural products at all,
mm-hmm.
except as guests. Hosts we define as having convergent binding sites and guests as divergent binding sites for complexing partners.
Mm-hmm.
And we're dealing with binding energies that range from 5 to, I guess the highest we've encountered is something like 28 kilocalories per mole.
Mm-hmm.
We've designed a host that binds lithium by about 28 kilocalories. Lithium ion.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole lot of stuff like that. But
okay.
This is one area that I think is going to be a big thing in the future, simply because, well, for a number of reasons. One is that the biotic world is such a wonderful world, shows what can be done.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why the organic chemist can't have a piece of this with completely synthetic systems.
Yeah.
And that's one direction. Another direction that's going in, of course, is toward the other elements of the periodic table.
Yes.
And that's going to go on for a long time, probably as long as there are chemists doing research.
Yeah.
Separation science is going to get a big play using very highly designed complexes to separate things,
mm-hmm.
both inorganic and organic.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion. Another thing I think is going to get a big play is the making of compounds and the molecular weight range of maybe 1,500 to 3,000, which will do remarkable things with regard to being able, for example, to carry reactions out in water as solvent, but in effect carry them out in the center of a hole that's dissolved in water.
Mm-hmm.
And this type thing, in
yeah.
other words, phase transfer chemistry
yeah.
of one type or
yeah.
another.
Yeah.
Simply because water is much easier to dispose of than organic medium, it's cheaper. Also, the compounds in this molecular weight region that have designed and specific structures just haven't been studied very much, and getting the effects of cooperativity of various functions,
mm-hmm.
catalysis, whatnot,
yeah.
the stereospecificity, all of this is going to get a big play,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And is very challenging. I think natural product chemistry, the waste product side of it, such as alkaloids and terpenes, are going to run out of gas pretty soon. In fact, I think they've run out of gas already.
Mm-hmm.
New reagents, new reactions will go on probably as long as there are organic chemists.
Right.
Physical organic chemistry, I think, is wearing thinner, and it's getting very, very highly refined now. And it really, I think, has had its period from the point of view of affecting the other sciences, the other branches of organic, the most.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think it's had its rosiest days.
Mm-hmm.
There's still some very nice things to be done in it, and will be done, I'm sure,
mm-hmm.
but it won't be central to a whole lot of other things the way it was during this Renaissance or whatever you want to call it, the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
But now what we consider physical organic chemistry has essentially been integrated into...
That's right, into the body of, of organic, and it's no longer thought of as physical organic.
Right.
The synthetic people have been so remarkably successful that they're running out of challenges. That's why I say that they're probably going to get into the design business a lot more, and they're going to be making highly sophisticated systems of much higher molecular weight to do things, rather than just to show that you can put an elegant structure together that resembles something nature did or something of this sort.
Yeah.
You get the idea?
Yeah.
And I figure that's going to get quite a big play. It was sort of interesting to me that finally the classical synthetic organic chemist is now sort of rediscovering stereospecificity. In other words, there's a problem that hasn't been solved by the organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
The organic chemist doesn't know how to catalyze specificity and doesn't know how to regulate it.
Mm-hmm.
Get it? He does in a few cases, and there's been some elegant examples.
Yeah.
But things like Johnson's wrap-up of the steroids, for example, a beautiful thing. That's an example of how you can work very hard for a long time and get a very high class result of stereospecificity in a wrap-up, a multi-chiral center operation.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, things like Woodward's synthesis of reserpine, that was a very highly stereospecific type synthesis, as I recall. Beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But as far as making chiral centers, making optically active compounds with chiral catalysts or with chiral reagents, that's a relatively untapped field.
Yes.
Can be a lot of that.
Yeah.
It's just starting up now.
What about the use of natural materials in a more sophisticated way than we've done before? That is, even using enzyme systems.
Well, they're being used to as starting materials now.
Yeah.
A lot of things that were looked upon as end products in the old days are now looked upon as starting materials, where you start with a sugar because you want some chiral centers.
Mm-hmm.
You start with amino acid because you want some chiral centers and you want to do new resolutions.
Yeah.
And we've taken the other tack. We've stayed away from natural systems, natural chirality.
Mm-hmm.
And have tried to work with what we thought was ideal rather than what we thought was available.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked with chiral binaphthol, for example,
mm-hmm.
or chiral paracyclophenyl, or things of this sort, units that we've designed and made.
Yeah.
You see, that are very unnatural.
Mm-hmm.
But this is going to have a big big play, I'm sure, this kind of organic chemistry, partly because there's a lot of organic chemists doing a lot of research and they want to do something new, and they're running out of some of the old things that have already been done.
Okay.
And so they're going to be looking for new fields, and one of the new fields that's almost limitless. And it's, for example, let's just ask the simple question, how many compounds have there been made that have holes in them big enough to accommodate other molecules or ions? And where the holes are enforced. In other words, they exist when there isn't something in them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer is there aren't any, up to very recently. Now, there are some naturally occurring holes. They're the lipophilic pockets in the proteases. There are the cyclodextrins. They're naturally occurring. They're made by bacteria. But the crowns fold up on themselves and fill up their own cavities.
Mm-hmm.
The cryptands do the same thing. You look at the X-ray structures of those hosts, they don't have any holes in them. They have holes that become holes when guests get in them. The occupants organize them. You get the idea?
Yes.
How about pre-organization? Well, we are addressing this problem very hard. And we've got several pre-organized systems now. You have to deal with very rigid groups. These are composed of aryl rings. Mm-hmm. Kekulene is an example of a compound with a hole in it. Mm-hmm. You know kekulene?
No.
Straubing kekulene.
Mm-hmm.
Kekulene is a hydrocarbon made out of benzene rings arranged in a cycling. It's like coronene, only it's the outer ring. It's one more, you know, coronene is benzene rings around in a circle.
Yes.
Well, if you go one more big ring out further, you've got kekulene.
Oh, I see. So you just built another ring of benzene rings on the outside of that.
Not on the out. Well, there's a hole in the middle.
Yeah.
And the hole is defined by six hydrogen, is I think defined by six inward looking hydrogens.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that much bigger. It melts something like 600 degrees, 550 degrees or something like this. Well, we've got some holes that will accommodate sodium, holes that will accommodate lithium,
mm-hmm.
holes that will accommodate cyclohexane. And some holes that are bigger than that.
What about porphyrin systems? I mean, those normally just accommodate the metals that you're talking about.
Actually, porphyrins don't exist unless there's magnesium or hydrogen in the holes.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, or copper.
You can't yank that out and just leave the hole.
That's right.
Yeah, I see.
In other words, the holes are made by, in a sense, magnesium getting in there or cobalt getting in there are made by displacing hydrogen
mm-hmm.
that was there before.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
And you can go through the literature looking for holes and you don't find them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're now being invented.
Yeah.
Gucci just got his hands on the glycerine, some of the 8 glycerine that obviously have holes in them. There are crystallographic holes, but that's a different matter. That's an intermolecular matter.
Mm-hmm.
You get the idea?
Yeah.
So we're addressing this business of making holes. That's fun. That's never been fun. And you run into some very interesting things.
Yeah.
Holes don't like to exist. It's quite troublesome to make these things.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
Exactly. Well, some van der Waal attractive forces are better than none.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to. Even if they have to be intramolecular, the things, molecules will fold on themselves if they have a chance because there's something to be gained by it.
Yeah.
Do you get the idea?
Yes.
Well, here's a field that nobody has fussed with nor recognized as an interesting field and phenomenon in its own right.
Yeah.
Until very recently, and I think we're either the first or among the first
mm-hmm.
to do this because there's a lot of profit to be gained by this.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting things, hanging functional groups around the periphery of these holes.
Yeah.
You can get cooperativity and you can get separation mm-hmm. of charge and concentration or charge gradients that you can make use of in catalysis, all sorts of interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in inorganic chemistry, the zeolites have holes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's the zeolites do wonderful things.
Yeah. Sounds absolutely fascinating.
So that's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we use CPK molecular models as our guide in this work. These are based on X-ray of natural occurring compounds. Well, here's an example of a compound with a hole in it that we've made. It's got 6 benzene rings attached to one another. This will accommodate sodium and lithium. Here's for example, something with the diameter of sodium.
Uh-huh.
And it holds on to it. This binds.
Where do you got methoxy groups on the inside?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is methoxies. These are 2 methoxies, and these are 2 ethylene bridges. And you can't turn a methylene inward because the hole is too small to accommodate a methylene. And it's rigid. It can't.
So this isn't like
itself.
A tunnel. This is a real hole built into.
This is a hole under electron pairs.
Yeah.
That's why it holds on to metals so well.
Yeah.
This holds on to sodium with about 23 kilocalories per mole.
Uh-huh.
Binding.
Now I understand why that.
And chloroform.
The binding is so strong.
Here's an example of a of a transition state model, molecular model with two monapholes, where you have a chiral environment in which you're carrying out an addition of an alkyl lithium to a carbonyl.
Mm-hmm.
And the alkyl lithium is complex by these two amino groups. And you can get something like 95 enantiomeric excess of adding good lithium to benzaldehyde in the presence of this diamine.
This is some of the kind of
research we're doing. Here's another hole that's designed. This is a cryptosphereand, what we call a cryptosphereand.
Mm-hmm.
Two nitrogens and inward-looking oxygens. These are the kinds of things that we play with all the time. Here's our carbamotrypsin model. We've made about half of this.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a peptide. Here's a binding site. Here's a carboxyl of an aspartase, mm-hmm. aspartic acid. Here's an imidazole. And here's mm-hmm. the serine hydroxyl equivalent.
Yeah.
And here's the proton relay system. Here's the nucleophile right next to the carbonyl group of an amide.
Mm-hmm.
And this is designed, this is a urea unit, it's hydrogen bonded here and here on the ammonium ion. Here's a pyridine that provides another binding site.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all rigid, it's all pre-organized.
I see, but you put the benzene rings around it just to
hold
everything in place.
Yeah, they're all placed on this rigid structure. See, there's very few degrees of structural conformational freedom in this molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got it made up to this part. All this made, we know that this complex is this and all that.
Mm-hmm.
All the background work is done. Now we're trying to put this rest of this together.
I see.
This, and this.
Mm-hmm.
This is some of the stuff that's going on. Here's a hole. We haven't made that, but we think we can make this very easily. Coenzymes. People are modifying enzyme sites so that they carry out reactions they weren't designed to do.